Welcome to the Economics Explored podcast. I'm your host, Gene Tunney. This is episode 63 on The Great Reset. Joining me today to discuss The Great Reset is Darren Brady Nelson, Chief Economist at LibertyWorks, an Australian libertarian think tank, and a research fellow at the Heartland Institute. Darren, good to have you back on the program.
Yeah, great to be back. Thank you.
Excellent. Darren, this is your fourth appearance on the podcast. We've previously spoken about the gig economy and surveillance capitalism, and there are some developments in those areas that I'd like to speak about before we go.
Oh, well, actually, five appearances. You forgot, gig, surveillance, capitalism, infrastructure, gold price, and now the Great Reset.
Sorry, Darren, you're absolutely right. Right. And yes, that's right.
Some of them were forgettable.
You're my most frequent guest, I believe, so that's great. Okay.
Keep it available.
I thought it'd be good to chat with you about the Great Reset because you're someone who's previously worked for a politician. You've worked for an Australian senator, and I think it's important to get that perspective into the discussion about the Great Reset. So the Great Reset, for people who don't know about it, it's this idea that COVID-19 means that we need to reset all of these policy settings in the global economy. The chair of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, so this is the World Economic Forum, which is associated with the Davos Talk Fest that they have in Switzerland. We can chat about that later. Klaus Schwab has said that the pandemic represents a rare but narrow opportunity to reflect, reimagine, and reset our world. Okay. And Klaus Schwab wrote a book earlier this year. He co-authored a book, COVID-19, The Great Reset. And I'll just read this out because I think this sets up the issues for discussion. COVID-19 is likely to sound the death knell of neoliberalism, a corpus of ideas and policies that can loosely be defined as favoring competition over solidarity, creative destruction over government intervention, and economic growth over social welfare. Darren, to begin with, could I just ask, do you think COVID-19 will sound the death knell of neoliberalism, whatever that is?
Yeah, I love that term. Only people on the left use that term, neoliberalism. You know, people on the right will use terms like libertarianism, conservatism, maybe classical liberalism, you know, those sorts of stuff. So it's quite a odd term that they've... I find lots of people on the left tend not to really know much about their so-called opponents on the right, whereas us on the right usually study the left quite closely, you know, from Karl Marx through to the modern day sort of environmental movement, etc. To answer your question, yet to be determined.
Absolutely. So what do you think generally about this, the core thesis of this Great Reset, that there was something fundamentally wrong with the policy settings in the global economy that we had leading into COVID? So what has been expressed by the people in favor of this Great Reset is that there was too much inequality, there was growing inequality in advanced economies, there was the rise of the big tech companies, although I think the big tech companies do send people to that Davos Talk Fest. There are concerns about the environment. There are concerns about climate change, that we're not doing enough about climate change, and that therefore we need to radically change our policy settings. And we have, this is a big topic of conversation at that Davos meeting that they have every year in Switzerland, where they gather together business people and leaders of non-government organisations. What do you think about that idea that there was something fundamentally wrong with the basic policy settings we had?
Well, look, it's a complex. It's a yes and no. The economies today are just so mixed. You know, the mixed economy has been around now, you know, for quite, like, you know, I guess if you get technical, it's always been around, the mixed economy. But, you know, it's really grown, you know, from maybe, you know, 80 private, 20 public to something, you know, more in the 50-50 range, if you like. And I think people on the right and the left are pretty unhappy with a lot of the policies, particularly, but let's put aside sort of the Trump years, the past 4 years, that, you know, this kind of dissatisfaction certainly has been going since the GFC, right? I'd say probably longer, but certainly from the GFC onwards. And often people on the left and the right often talk about the same problems, but the thing is they see that the problems are caused by totally different things, and they think the solutions are totally different, right? So it comes down to, again, this ongoing battle for, you know, certainly 200 years, I suppose, or something like that, of government's the solution or freedom and markets are the solution. I think it's again, that battle. Now, it takes on more subtle approaches nowadays. I think, you know, some of the people driving things like the Great Reset aren't out-and-out socialists, for instance. You know, they actually are probably more akin, you know, and I don't use this in a pejorative way, more of a fascist economy, which is this partnership, that, you know, in a technical sense, if you take out, you know, fascists as people with jackboots and are often racist, which isn't always the case because the Italian fascists weren't racist, but the German ones were. Put that all aside, the fascist economy is really about the government working hand in hand with big business and often with big labor unions to direct the economy, at least at the commanding heights level. Usually not ownership, outright ownership of the means of production like socialism was. But again, you know, it's not quite the same thing as 1930s fascism either. It's taken aspects of that.
Okay. Rather than fascist, would corporatist be a better description of what you're talking about there?
Corporatist is really just a nicer sounding version of fascism, so that's fine. Corporatist, and then there's some other terms that are bandied around like that. So I'm not saying it's like a straight up fascist movement straight out of the 30s or anything like that, but it grabs some bad elements of that, including the, you know, the just hyper focus on identity. You know, whether, you know, what's your color of your skin, what's your gender, all these sorts of things, which, you know, is straight out of the 30s playbook, sadly. They just choose who the heroes and the villains are. They're different, you know, than from the 1930s. So look, you know, what I'm getting at is this movement, you know, we're economists and we'll talk about a lot of the economic aspects of this, but it's got some really, you know, more deeper cultural, it's the culture wars, you know, is integral to this. You need to understand economics, you need to understand the culture wars, you need to understand the history of these international organizations, you know, starting with Wilson, going through to FDR, going through to Lord Keynes, who was also not only a proponent of these international organizations, but he was also a eugenicist as well.
Okay, look, let me just play this video from the World Economic Forum, because you're right that there is this concern about, well, they're promoting diversity, but people would argue that that's a good thing because we've had groups in society that have been traditionally underrepresented. So I'll play this video from Davos, and then we can have a chat about that later. But I think this is a very interesting video because the Davos organization has clearly been wanting to improve its reputation. So I remember 25 years ago, Davos was seen as this nefarious group of business people and, you know, the so-called, you know, neoliberal economists who were wanting to promote globalization. So Davos used to be criticized by the left, but now it's increasingly being criticized by the right, which it's just a fascinating turnaround. Let me just play this for you, Darren, and we'll get some reactions.
Egypt is Davos.
Oh, so Davos is just male, stale, and pale, right?
Not so much, actually. Now, I'm not going to blame anyone for thinking of this when you think of Davos. Because, hey, for a while, the forum was dominated by older white men. But these mannels, they're a thing of the past. By comparison, the number of women at the annual meeting surpasses global averages. And pale? Well, not so much these days. You see, Davos started as a European management conference. And now, it looks to every corner of the globe, welcoming perspectives from, well, every corner of the globe. So when you drop by the channel this time, you're not going to see a lineup of old white men, but you might see something a bit more like this, as this year's forum is set to be the most representative yet.
Okay, cool, but Davos is some sort of secret underground cult, right?
Davos is not some secret underground cult. Next.
Do you have to be rich to go to Davos?
Companies do pay to come here. They pay a lot, actually. But when it comes to civil society, scholars, scientists, activists, and the media, they come for free. Because help.
Okay, Darren, did you hear that?
No, I didn't hear any of that.
Oh. Okay, so, I didn't hear your
executive summary.
Okay, I should have put it on one of my sound pads and then played it to you. Basically, it was saying that once upon a time, Davos used to be pale, male, and stale, and now it's much more diverse. And they said that, you know, Davos now looks like this, and they showed a diverse group of people. So Davos is clearly trying to change its reputation. Perhaps Klaus Schwab and some of the people involved in World Economic Forum, maybe they feel they feel guilty in some way for changes in the global economy. Although what always surprises me is that they're often missing all the good things that have happened in the global economy over the last 30 years associated with globalization, including the billions of people globally who've come out of poverty. It always strikes me as strange that they've made this switch. So are you arguing that these cultural factors are as much behind the change in the attitudes of the people at Davos or the lead, like people like Klaus Schwab and business leaders around the world, that's as much at play as their diagnosis of the economic situation? Would that be a good summary?
Look, I would view it a little bit differently. I don't think anybody's minds have been changed, you know, at Davos over the past 330 years or thereabouts. I think they just basically left-wing activists have put their people in place over time. And there's been more people like that in the corporate world, you know, in recent times. You know, if you see any big corporation in Australia or the US, they're, most of these people are very sympathetic to, you know, socialism, corporatism, all these basically things that involve heavy government intervention, cartelization of industries, monopolization of industries. They probably won't literally say that, but you know, the outcomes speak for themselves. You know, you can see it in big tech. You can see it in a lot of, you know, the woke corporations don't tend to come from industries that are highly competitive. They come from the less competitive industries and they kind of go hand in hand. One, woke people don't really like things like competition and freedom for the most part. And also when you have a cartelized or a monopolized industry, you can afford to be woke. Woke is not like a formula for, in a competitive market. It just won't win you. So you need government interventions. You need government favors. Big tech, you know, they didn't just get to where they are purely by being great innovators and competitors, although they certainly, a lot of them started out like that. But now they're kind of comfortable and fat and love their Section 230 privileges in the US that don't just give them privileges in the US. Those privileges then help protect them around the world.
Yes, that's one of the points you made earlier in the year when we spoke about this. And I think, yes, we were ahead of the actual policy developments, because recently there's been talk about perhaps curtailing those privileges, that privilege under Section 230, if they don't provide free speech, if they are censoring content on their platform. So I think that was a really interesting conversation, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Okay, let's get to specific policies that would come out of this Great Reset. And one of them is greater redistribution. So there's a general concern about growing inequality. And I think this is probably more of a concern in some advanced economies than others. Perhaps in the US and UK, you could argue that there has been increasing inequality, particularly at the real top end. You see the superstars, you see the tech billionaires. And so one of the things that they appear to be arguing in this Great Reset is that we need to have higher tax rates on corporations, for example. You could argue for wealth taxes, that type of thing. I think Elizabeth Warren had a proposal like that in the when she was running for the nomination for the Democratic Party. But one thing we've got to recognise is that these policies have to be implemented at a national level. It's all very well and good for these business people and leaders of NGOs to talk about all this at Davos and in other forums, but ultimately it has to be done at a national level. How influential do you think this Great Reset that's being promoted by Davos can be if it has to be decided at a national level? Is this just a talk fest, or is it going to have any? Is it just a talking point of the Davos set, or will it actually have some practical impact?
I think a lot of these ideas have been increasingly implemented around the world in every country at different levels and, you know, in different ways. Because all these organizations, they're all tied together. You know, they specifically talk about, you know, you need to do things that the IMF say, you need to do things that WHO says, obviously in the context of the pandemic. They have massive legs. I mean, you know, in Australia, you know, like the second, you know, a government signs up to any of these sort of treaties, and they just have all this sort of stuff in it, you know, even if the treaty is normally about something else, this stuff's always thrown in. And, you know, that's one of the reasons, you know, Trump originally didn't want to sign up for TPP. It had this sort of stuff in it. And why, you know, NAFTA had similar sort of stuff in it, and why he wanted to, you know, he's basically, you know, very much against those sorts of ideas, those kind of like globalist top-down central planning type of approaches, which is really, just to throw into these kind of cultural approaches, which is really the reason why so many people in media and big tech hate Trump. It's not so much his style, although they can point to that, you know, as an easy thing for, you know, some of their followers to go, oh yeah, his style is whatever. And no, it's because he's just the biggest disruptor to this sort of agenda that the world has seen ever. I'm including even Reagan and Thatcher didn't fight back against this sort of stuff with any vigor, nor did John Howard or, you know, other sort of conservative leaders, and certainly not Boris Johnson, and certainly not Scott Morrison either. So it has legs. It has legs. And, you know, if you look at the Democrat platform under Joe Biden, you know, lest he be president, which is obviously looking likely, but he's not. He's not president-elect just yet. You know, he's taken on board the Elizabeth Warren ideas, the Bernie Sanders ideas, the AOC ideas, and then also thrown in all the kind of Clinton ideas as well. So, you know, it's crony capitalism meets socialism in the middle as corporatism.
Okay, we'll see how events play out in the US. I want to read another.
But, you know, it's in their platform. It's, you know, it's a 100 plus page platform. It's not speculation. You can just go read it. It's there.
Okay. I mean, my understanding is that Joe Biden is fairly centrist, isn't he? And I mean,
no,
the progressives
not.
On the. Well,
he's not.
Okay. Well,
he, look, you know, okay. Whether he is or not, we'll never know what's in his head. you know, we can look at his words over the years, and then he's changed, you know, he's basically shown himself to be a person who doesn't really have any particular principles, but the people backing up are fairly radical people. They're radical socialists. They're also radical corporatists as well. The radical internationalists, you know, from at least from a U.S. traditional perspective, and this is, you know, let's not saying traditional, not just the Republican Party, but what the Democrat Party at least once was, at least from Bill Clinton going backwards. Now, certainly Obama, Biden, that's a different beast. But no, I would not at all say that. He's a chameleon. He is what he needs to be. And at this moment, he's on board with sort of the Great Reset.
Yeah. Well, the progressives in the Democratic Party certainly reject the policies of the Clinton era. They reject what they see Clinton as someone who supported neoliberalism, as they call it. And Clinton signed NAFTA, if I remember correctly. And he had, who was it? Was it Robert Rubin, who was his Treasury Secretary? Then Larry Summers. They don't like either of those people. So, yeah, we'll see how it all plays out. Okay, I want to read another passage from The Great Reset. In the post-pandemic era, for reasons related to the redefinition of the social contract, this scrutiny will intensify. They're talking about scrutiny of tech companies. Companies that rely on gig workers to operate will also feel the effect of more government interference, possibly even to a degree capable of undermining their financial viability. As the pandemic will radically alter social and political attitudes towards gig workers, governments will force these companies that employ them to offer proper contracts with benefits such as social insurance and health coverage. The labour issue will loom large for them, and if they have to employ gig workers as normal employees, they will cease to be profitable. Now, I think I just read the wrong passage.
It's a good passage. I'm happy to comment on it.
Yes. It's going on about you know, the problems with gig workers, and I remember when we had our previous conversation, I mean, we generally came out in favour of gig work. I mean, I know just how much better things are for me with the Uber that's come in, and how much easier it is to get around, and how much we used to be getting ripped off by taxis, how hard it was to get taxis. So generally I'm in favour of the gig economy. I think it's been an amazing innovation. But there's this general feeling that people are being exploited and ripped off, and they're not earning enough to make a living. So there's that general concern. But I'm not sure it's we should have the government interfere in markets to ensure that. I think that, and this is what we have in Australia, if you have a decent social safety net that provides support to people if they don't have work, and guarantees a certain standard of living, I think that's probably a better way to do it than to intervene in markets themselves. Would you, do you have any thoughts on that, Darren?
Well, look, California in the recent election voted against, you know, sort of like taking the rights away from the gig economy in California. And that's, you know, one of the most socialist, quite kind. It's certainly the most left-leaning state in the United States, and they didn't buy it that, you know, they were, you know, that the workers were being exploited, the customers were being exploited. People were pretty happy with the arrangement with Uber and other sort of gig economy workers. So no, that doesn't mean it's, you know, look, I have to come back to, again, I think the thing that drives the Great Reset and all these ideas, it's not some, you know, sort of like looking at the evidence, and, you know, the evidence is suggesting things are just getting terrible and worse, and it's markets' fault. Increasingly, I found that people have a religious belief in these ideas, and there is really no facts that are ever going to convince them otherwise. And that's why we're at this kind of divided state, not just in the U.S. I mean, Australia is very divided, too, on these sorts of ideas. This kind of left-right divide is everywhere. It's like, you know, pretty much everywhere in the world. And, you know, so many people on the left really, you know, have a religious devotion to these ideas. You know, they're not going to change it. Then no matter how often socialism or anything or corporatism fails, they never think to go, oh, if things aren't working out, maybe it's this kind of corporatist model that's not working. You know, because we haven't had anything approaching free market capitalism since prior to 1914, right?
Yeah.
So to keep on blaming capitalism for the ills of this world is, you know, almost laughable. This guy's like, you know, look, it's hardly any part of the economy anymore. When you take into account regulation, there is almost nothing. In fact, I'd probably say nothing is not regulated in the economy, right? Now, so you're just asking to what degree is it regulated, really? You know, utilities, you know, super heavily regulated. Other stuff like Uber, not as much, but there's always something, right? So
yeah.
So if facts really played a more significant role, I don't think things like the Great Reset would really have any popularity. Now, I still think, actually, for the most part, it's not popular, the Great Reset. Nor are COVID in the U.S., COVID lockdowns are, for the most part, not popular. I can't speak for Queensland and Victoria. They seem to, for whatever reason, be popular. But, you know, again, this stuff isn't driven by an actual fact of COVID being, you know, the Black Death revisited or even the Spanish flu revisited. Because, you know, at best, there's good arguments on both sides for lockdowns and not having lockdowns. Because, you know, most countries lock down to some extent, yet they're on their third wave of COVID cases, right? Whereas Sweden, Singapore, South Korea, Japan, Taiwan didn't have as, you know, Sweden's got a little bit of an uptick, but it's, you know, it's in the middle of Europe. So, and obviously islands can protect themselves regardless of what policies they use a lot better, you know, New Zealand, Australia, Japan. But then again, there's exceptions like the United Kingdom. So, you know, like, the data is not giving you, you know, it's not saying like, oh, lockdowns are the way to go and they work really well, right? You know, I'm not saying the data is 100% on the other side of it, but so basically these people, as they've even openly admitted, you know, you mentioned the person who runs the World Economic Forum, but, you know, the Canadian Prime Minister, they're saying the same things. There's politicians in the U.S. saying exactly the same thing. This is our opportunity to do all the things we wanted to do anyway.
Right. Well, they see the opportunity in the crisis. Don't waste a good crisis. Was that what Rahm Emanuel told Barack Obama at some stage, I think? Yes, yes. Yeah.
And Professor Robert Higgs has written, you know, brilliant books on this subject of, you know, the ratchet effect and how governments use the opportunity of any crisis, a war, anything, a pandemic, to ratchet up their influence and power.
Yes, yes. Now, I want to go back to this point about these policies not necessarily being popular. I absolutely agree with you there because, well, let's look at Australia. The last election, the last federal election in Australia, Scott Morrison, the leader of the Conservative Liberal National Coalition, that's funny in Australia how Conservative parties call a Liberal Party.
Well, it's classical Liberal. I think its name goes back to those days, yeah.
That's right. It goes back to the late 40s when Robert Menzies was campaigning against the restrictions that were still on the economy at the time that were a hangover from wartime. Okay, but going back to the 2019 election, the opposition Labor Party had proposed changes to taxation policies, which in their view would have closed these loopholes that were favouring the rich. Okay. Now, it turns out these tax measures ended up, they were to the benefit of a lot of people in middle Australia. We're talking about rules around investment properties and the taxation of dividends. And Scott Morrison, surprisingly, given the polls and what all of the commentators were saying, and I didn't expect him to get re-elected, I thought he was gone, Scott Morrison ended up being returned as PM. And it looks like Australians, or middle Australia, that determine the election, didn't want those policies. They didn't see these negative gearing and franking credits policies as being loopholes or being responsible for mass inequality. And the other point I'd make is that in Australia, even though we had a PM that once said that climate change was the greatest moral challenge of our generation, we Australians voted in a government that scrapped the carbon tax. So I think you're right that these policies aren't necessarily popular. Re-lockdowns, they are popular in Queensland and in Victoria. That's correct. In the US, I take your point that they're generally not popular.
Although I would have to say, we'll see if they really are popular in Victoria. But obviously, in Queensland, you could certainly say, given the very recent election, that they were at least sufficiently popular.
Okay. But one policy which does appear to be popular in the US and in Australia too is the minimum wage. There's a lot of support for raising the minimum wage, and we saw that Florida, on the day of the presidential election, they had their own referendum on the minimum wage, I think, and they supported lifting it to $15 an hour. So let me just read another passage from this this book. This was the one I was going to read originally. Around the world, the pressure to improve the social protection and salary level of low-paid employees will increase. Most likely in our post-pandemic world, increases in the minimum wage will become a central issue that will be addressed via the greater regulation of minimum standards and a more thorough enforcement of the rules that already exist. Most probably, companies will have to pay higher taxes and various forms of government funding like services for social care. The gig economy will feel the impact of such a policy more than any other sector. Okay. So any thoughts about this general push to increase minimum wages across the US, generally up to about $15 an hour? That's seen as a fair level. Do you have any concerns about that push, Darren?
Well, it's probably one of the things that most economists from most schools of thought, not all, agree that, you know, minimum wage, everything else equal, just creates more unemployment, right? And it creates more unemployment in the people that are most vulnerable. So it usually hits, obviously, the poorer people. And, you know, if you want to go back, and I don't think color or culture really at the end of the day is as important as individuals and their character, but fine. You know, it hurts black people and brown people a lot more than it hurts white people when you raise minimum wages.
Yeah, I agree with you. Because I did a monologue on this issue of several episodes back, and I said, well, there's basically one study which might have said that it had a positive impact, which was that Card and Kruger study, but it looked like there was a problem with their survey methodology, and that study went against the hundreds of other studies which found the opposite. So, yeah, absolutely.
Well, yeah, Eamon Butler, who's at the Adam Smith Institute in the United Kingdom, he wrote a book, you know, the 10,000 years of history of price controls, including wage controls. So, you know, this has actually been going around for a long time. It's never worked out well in the Roman Empire, pre-revolutionary France, well, post-revolutionary France, I should say, et cetera, through to modern days. Again, you know, these ideas just are impervious to facts. So, you know, what is the solution? I'm not sure. You know, people on the right, libertarians, conservatives, classical liberals, et cetera, we're still trying to figure out, you know, how to battle, you know, what we say are just terrible ideas that actually hurt the people that they say they're going to help. And you can no longer claim that it's just unintended consequences when it's been happening for so long, including, you know, I think the evidence for, you know, environmental solutions through more and more central planning has a bad record as well. I think, you know, free market and common law solutions have a much better track record if you allow them to work. You know, for instance, in the 19th century in the U.S., you know, they often, in the Western U.S., they often refer to, oh, look at what happened with, you know, the free falling of trees. You know, that was capitalism. No, it wasn't. It was government who owned the land, you know, like the equivalent of crown land or the commons, who then, you know, at the time, these governments, instead of having kind of an environmental slant, they had a pro-growth, pro-development slant. And then they said, well, go in, we're not allowing you to own these trees, forestry companies, which they said they wanted to. They said, you know, we want to own these plots and then manage them over like 20 years, 30 years, that sort of stuff. They said, well, you're not allowed to. So just your choice is either go in and lop as much down as you can or just don't, right? So they did. And you'll find that's also the case with fisheries, et cetera. They're often things that are blamed on the market really are actually government and government's refusal to manage the commons better through more free market oriented processes.
Right. Okay. Look, I'll have to put a link to that book by the Adam Smith Institute. That sounds fascinating. What is it? 10,000 years of price controls?
Yeah, I'll send it. I'll pop it through. You know, because I think any good economist really needs to also, you know, if they weren't taught it at university, they need to go and read history. I think actually history could be almost more important. Yeah, they both kind of go hand in hand nicely, you know, understanding of economic concepts with history. And I don't say that just because I studied economic history at university. I've actually found it actually is really sheds, a true light on things.
Yes, yes. Okay. Before we go, I just want to get your sense of, I think we've covered this already to an extent, but to what extent should we be worried about this great reset if we think it could usher in all of these, you know, radical changes to policy, which while arguably well-intentioned could lead to adverse consequences? And I've noticed that this has happened in the last couple of weeks, particularly in Australia, there's been more discussion about it. It looks like a lot of people who would be labelled as conservatives are very concerned about it. So one of my old friends, Senator Matt Canavan, he was on Sky recently, Sky in Australia, and he said that the Great Reset is crazy, kooky stuff. You'll own no property and you'll be happier, apparently. And Senator Canavan went on to say that the real battle line is between those who want to allow people to take control of their own lives, communities and states, and those who are pushing for one unified global order that takes away agency or sovereignty from any individual. Now, Darren, as someone who has worked for an Australian senator, how could this Great Reset, which is being promoted by the Davos set, how could it actually lead to this unified global order? I think it seems to me that we're so far away from that. Is this something we really should be worried about? I know we've touched on this before, but if you could just wrap this up for us, please, that would be great.
I would agree with the senator. Maybe for slightly different reasons and a slightly different take on things. But yes, we should be very worried. 2020 to me has shown how far these sorts of things have actually advanced. It's a bit, I won't call them crazy. I don't think they're crazy at all. If they're crazy, they'd probably be sloppy and they probably wouldn't have much of a chance of getting things done. They're not crazy. There's a lot of smart people and a lot of money behind these sorts of things. Basically what they're looking to, one of their chief places they look to as a model is communist China. And how they have that new system of like, you get ranked, in terms of, what you can do and what you can't do. That is exactly, and that's been happening in the US. It's happening in Australia. It's not far off at all. It's actually arrived. And the question is it going to go a bit further? And is it going to be entrenched? I've been sitting in the US for the past year and I've never seen anything like this, to the extent that so many governments, big tech corporations, pharmaceutical companies, banks are all literally singing the exact same song sheet. And then obviously throw on media, et cetera. I've never seen, it's almost as though there's one person sort of like writing something up and then it just gets distributed. I know that's not literally happening, but something's going on. And it is scary. It didn't come out of nowhere. They've just taken advantage of the situation with COVID this year, and then throw in stuff like BLM, et cetera, and all that. If you cherish at least some degree of freedom, you should be worried. You don't have to be a libertarian level of freedom lover to be concerned. And I think there's a lot of people on the left. We've seen people, you know, traditional, if you like, left-wing liberals who are very worried too, who've, you know, like they've had instances of this chap who founded, you know, a left liberal sort of media outfit. He's quit from it because, you know, he's seen that his colleagues have become so tyrannical. You know, they're against free speech. They're against freedom of movement, all sorts of stuff.
Okay. You're talking about Glenn Greenwald, are you?
With The Intercept. That's the man, yeah. There's something to be very concerned about. I don't think they're the majority, but they do command. They're certainly in charge of the commanding heights. You know, to use that phrase again, I forgot the economist who came up with that term. You might remember.
Wasn't Clem Attlee, was it? The commanding heights, I think that was associated with nationalisation first, wasn't it, in the 40s in Britain? I don't know. There's that idea that government needed to take over the commanding heights of the economy.
Yeah.
And then there was that book written by Daniel Yergin, I think, in the 90s or early 2000s called The Commanding Heights, which was about how we went from nationalisation to denationalisation, then renationalisation again, this is in Britain, and then privatisation under Thatcher. A fascinating book.
Well, things are different now because the commanding heights, the government doesn't literally need to take over big tech or anything like that. But these people are on board with the same ideas. You know, they even if, for instance, they're not necessarily devoted, you know, in their heart to some of these ideas, they see how cartelization, monopolization, obviously, like in any industry, can get you supernormal profits better than competition can. So, you know, you have, if you like, the Baptists and bootleggers have really come together like they've never had before, at least that I'm aware of in the past 150 years.
Mm. I want to go back to, there's one point I want to explore just before we wrap up. I think it's a really interesting point you made about, I think it was about the changes in attitudes in, we're more likely to impose restrictions on people's liberties than we ever were in the past to achieve policy goals. And this is what we've noticed with COVID. Now, I'm someone who thought that, like, I was very worried about COVID when I first learned about it, and I saw the need for the introduction of some policies to stop the spread. But what surprised me is just how willing governments and also how willing the general population has been to support those policies, how willing governments have been to continue with these policies for such an extended period, the restrictions, when I don't think we would have done this 30 or 40 years ago, certainly not if we still had a large cohort of people who grew up prior to the Second World War and went through the Depression and the war. I don't think that generation would really have put up with these restrictions. I think it's just extraordinary on such a sustained basis. So I see the need. I think there's a justification for some, but governments are very willing to impose these restrictions very quickly with absolutely no justification other than saying it's for your protection. So that's a... I think that is a concern. I'm concerned that there has been that lack of justification. What specific policies are you talking about in the... You mentioned policies in the US, policies in Australia, where it's related to... What was the point? Was it about... governments are very willing to impose restrictions. Are you just talking about COVID or are you talking about other things?
I think this is the... They've seen that this works for the most part. And I think everything is on the table over time on any sort of restrictions that they want to put on you for whatever reason. And of course, they always, whether it's true or not, or where it's just partially true or not, you know, they'll use public safety is like kind of the new mantra. The climate is now under public safety. Obviously, a pandemic is under public safety. Race is now under public safety. Gender is now under public safety. You know, unless people push back legally, politically, preferably peacefully, there is no limit. You know, sort of public choice economics through to, you know, reading things like Machiavelli will tell you, you know, this is the tendency of government if you allow it to do so. You know, the whole U.S., the founding of the U.S. is based on the idea that government tends to be tyrannical unless you actually put checks and balances in place and you act upon it. And you also have a populace who are educated intellectually, but also educated morally to, you know, sort of see it coming or at least do something about it when it arrives. You know, this has, you know, it didn't come overnight. I think it's just gone to new levels in 2020. And yes, you know, you wouldn't expect, you know, Australia of a certain period in the past to put up with this, or America, the same thing. But we're here now. And the question is, you know, it's clearly real, despite, you know, sort of a lot of left-wing media like the New York Times claiming it's a conspiracy theory by the right. Clearly it's not. You can go to these websites and sort of read what the plan is. And they're having a meeting at Davos next year about just this topic, the Great Reset. So it's certainly, you know, not in someone's imagination. So the, you know, the question is, what do you do about it? And obviously there might not be just one thing you can do about it. And it's all tied together. It all is really tied together. The whole battle to, you know, with the election here in the U.S., it's not completely tied to something like the Great Reset, but it's all part of the mix.
Okay, Darren, we'll have to leave it there. Look, I really appreciate your thoughts on and views on this this Great Reset, which is a topic of intense conversation at the moment. I really appreciate it. You've given me so much to think about. So thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Economics Explored podcast. If you're enjoying it, please tell your family and friends, and please give us a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or on whatever platform you're listening on. If you'd like to get in touch with any comments or to ask any questions, please email me at gene.tunney@gmail.com. Until next week, goodbye.